I've been incredibly lucky and grateful for the fact that the different projects I've worked on over the years, the documentaries, this podcast, lots of websites and other creations, have all in many ways found their audience. People have written to me and told me that they've stumbled onto work I've done and it's affected them in some way. They've offered to help me with projects in the future, and they've certainly enjoyed what they've seen so far. However, that said, there is a tiny sliver of folks who have not enjoyed my work, and as is natural, I've been obsessed about them for way too long. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Daniel Boyd, Peter Healy, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. You can't create something that thousands or tens of thousands of people see and expect 100% enjoyment of what it is. Some people don't like the genre of what you're working on, so even the best in that genre is still something terrible to them. This is just the nature of the world. People are not monolithic. They experience various works under a whole bunch of different conditions, and if you obsess for acceptance by everyone, you end up with something that's sort of interesting to everyone. When I set off to do a documentary about dial-up bulletin board systems, that had a built-in audience, people who had used them. And maybe it had a few more folks who had heard of BBSs but didn't have a large audiovisual experience to explain to them exactly what it was like to use them. After that, the audience drops pretty heavily. I've had people find that movie series who had no idea that this whole world existed, and they've written me with beautiful, long-winded letters about how much the series affected them. The same has happened for GitLamp, for this podcast, for everything that I've been working on. And I should be satisfied with that. Inspiring somebody, enough to have them want to write you and tell you how they feel, that's a gift handed to you on an electronic plate. There is honestly no room for feeling anything other than grateful. But every once in a while, somebody writes not just a dismissive letter, but a screed, an actual multi-paragraph rant about how one of my works isn't just something they don't like, but something they consider to be a negative force in the world, something that shouldn't have been created, something that was made with a malevolent calculus that will leave people poorer for having experienced it. I'm going to talk about this along two different lines of thought. The first is whether I should care at all what they think, and the second is about why this sort of thing happens. So my experience, and looking at other creative people, their experience as well, is that 100 people can tell you that something is decent, that you did a good job. But all it takes is one single person telling you it's awful, or that you did it wrong, or that you have created something that is a damaging presence, and you will focus, you will obsess. One single arrow tossed out from a field of applause, and ask yourself constantly if it's true. It's an unfortunate aspect of the world that negative feelings eclipse positive ones. No matter how much someone tells you that you've affected them positively, somebody coming along and just upending the entire cart leaves a lasting effect. I can see that nowhere stronger than in YouTube comments. This podcast is mirrored onto my YouTube account, where I also put up documentary clips and other video works I've done. And they'll sit there for years, completely benign with folks stopping in to say that they like one aspect or something else, or to tell a story inspired by whatever I'm talking about. But then a post will come in. And they seem to have the same format, enough that I sometimes think it's the same person. And they will be a long-form rant. There's one person who seems to have been on a multi-year effort to tear down the work I do. Weirdly enough, the posts don't last very long. They're usually between 4 and 12 paragraphs long. They go into a whole range of tangential subjects. And generally, it's usually an assessment not just of what's being said there, but some personal opinions as to what kind of person I am. And then they usually delete them a day or two later. Stuff like this has been happening for years. And of course, because it's posted on YouTube, I get a copy sent to me in email. So I have a record of all of these. I've been at this for a very, very long time. I've seen how dark and personal things can get. So for me, they're more like exhibits in a science museum. These very long, very intense descriptions of how my work is not just subpar, but dangerously incompetent. The fact that I'm mentioning this on a podcast is not even a reflection of it affecting me, but me thinking that there's a lesson to be learned here. I give a lot of advice to people. I share with their triumphs, and I give consolation when they're down. And I've seen how much a negative comment can affect a person's day. And I try to explain that people who wander in and upend your chessboard, knock over your table, they didn't invest anything. They didn't work on it with you and find that the final project is terrible. Commenting is free. There's no downside to doing it. You can comment endlessly on things that you've only thought about for 5 minutes, and in doing so, weigh heavily onto somebody for whom that project represents years. It's a completely imbalanced situation. I've watched people who put good work into something for a very long time be devastated for a while, trying to enumerate and figure out where they could have done things better, simply because somebody drove by with an opinion. Most of my advice on this is just weighing in as somebody who objectively can say, this is a good project you did, this is a wonderful effort, and giving them that boost that they really need at that time. Are the criticisms valid? Well, that brings up my second point. I've had negative comments over the years about my documentaries, and I do read them closely, because it would concern me that in an effort to only look at the bright side of things, I truly did bad work or could have improved with minor efforts and changes and made something better. And I'm glad to say, on the whole, I stand by where I went, which choices I made, how the final work came out. To explain further, a project that takes you years involves you looking at all the possibilities of how you could make it, what budgeting you have, either in terms of time or money or materials, whether or not you can even achieve one possible approach, and whether you should stick with what you know you'll get done. With the BBS documentary, I knew an enormous subject to cover without any real films to build off of. I didn't have a BBS documentary I was making a better version of. I felt like I was making the only long-form BBS documentary. I made a bunch of choices. I wrote these down. Could I get a crew? Could I shoot within a couple months? Should it be something I'm doing on the side? Should I quit my job and only do this and look for people to fund me? Should I talk about American BBSs, or should I try to go global? What were my limits in terms of how I was going to approach this? How much of it would be newly recorded interviews, and how much of it would be simple shots that I wove in to talk over? Should I narrate it? Should I have a host? Should it be one long movie or a bunch of smaller ones? Episodes, a miniseries. Each of these was an active, decided, debated choice that I made, reflecting me deciding from all of the options what I could get away with. When the documentary was done, 4 years later, I put it out, and it was generally positive. But every once in a while, I'll see one of these arrows, one of these comments, and I'll realize that they didn't know that I looked over all these options and made an active choice. They'll call it a talking head documentary, and that's because I chose to interview a whole bunch of people and show them in their environment. I didn't invent animations. I didn't create a whole bunch of sliding title cards or built-in interstitials filmed from scratch with actors. I interwove voices speaking together to emulate the feeling of a bulletin board system. The BBS documentary, in many ways, is a message thread, passed from person to person, from all sorts of times and places, and creating an oral history of what came before. Every time I see somebody say, "This is another talking head documentary," I literally rack my brain trying to think how I would have done it differently. But we now live in a world where content is freely available, available enough to fill every hour of the rest of your life. And with that overabundance of creation, you get to be picky. You get to say something doesn't satisfy you and move on. This isn't the single comic book you were able to get down at the store or the video game released that week for your console. This is a panoply, a buffet of endless interesting things. And after a while, you forget that each one is a major effort by one or more people to tell a story, to get a response, to fulfill a requirement. And so, in all of that, you sling an arrow to tell people it didn't move you. Make no mistake, one of my favorite activities is trying to imagine what a different BBS documentary would have been. Whether I would have set up reenactments or had some sort of action happening and then calling back to what bulletin board systems were. I've tried to think about what those would have been, those otherworldly documentaries I would have made. Get Lamp, the text adventure documentary, had the same complaints that it was only talking heads around text. And I'll tell you, I went through a lot of ideas with Get Lamp. It was going to be a lot more interactive. You were going to have to play an active part, and there was going to be a sort of meta story around all of it, an actual adventure happening while in the background you learned about the history of text adventures. This turned out to be many times more ambitious than I was capable of doing. And to be frank, it felt weird. It felt weird to constantly stop a movie and force the user to go through a choice to continue. The idea, which I did explore, started to suffer through the same problems that many interactive movies had suffered for years before. Standing on their graveyard, their body of failure, told me that this wasn't the way I was going to go. But as it stood, I ended up putting in one or two interactive choices simply because I had promised people this was going to be the case. I still don't like that choice, so there is an option to play it with none. Just a bog-standard movie that has a beginning, a middle, an end. So I guess this is a call for empathy. If you're lucky enough to be somebody who stumbles onto a project that is obviously a work of love and a work of personal effort, not to fulfill a contract, not to fill a slot on some sort of schedule, but an honest-to-goodness personal effort, I'd ask that you stay your hand before jumping in with the criticism, because that pebble you throw could be somebody else's avalanche of sadness and doubt. It could bury somebody wonderful. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to Forrest Fuqua, Emilio Oliveira, James Bakoyanu, Mark Pilgrim, Corey Thomas, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. I'm giving you permission for this episode to leave the most negative personal review you think you can do. Bring it on.